Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. In this episode, I sat down with Tom Gothier, a former nuclear, biological, and chemical specialist in the U.S. Army and the CEO for AgTech Logic. Tom doesn't just talk about precision spraying trends or sugar-coated aspects of entrepreneurship. He pulls back the curtain on what it's really like to build a mission-driven ag tech company from the ground up, while still staying grounded in both his military roots and a practical field-based understanding of farming. In this episode, we break down how Tom and his team are combining chlorophyll fluorescent sensors with real-time data capture and AI-enhanced analytics, not just to spot spray weeds, but to identify things like standing water, detect disease early, and even feed actionable intel back into the supply chain. We get into questions like, how did Tom's prior work as a chemical engineer with Procter & Gamble influence his path into ag tech? Why won't cameras alone be sufficient for addressing a growing host of weed and disease-related problems? And can chlorophyll fluorescent sensors do more than just detect green weeds against a brown dirt background? You'll hear how AgTech Logic's precision spraying systems are helping producers save hundreds of gallons of crop protection products per application. This is a candid conversation about earning trust, staying adaptable, and leading with humility. Let's get into it.
My grandfather was a farmer up in Wisconsin. My dad farmed for just a fraction of a moment, and he realized that farming was really hard, wasn't able to make the farm profitable. So he moved to Chicago, and I grew up in Chicago. So I grew up a Chicago kid. We moved to the suburbs when I was seven. Had the opportunity to go up to the farm when I was during the summers, and got a chance to drive the tractor, run around the farm a bit, hang out in the barn with the cats and such. So, pretty normal, upbringing, four brothers. My dad worked really hard. He was an electrician. He eventually got his GED. My mom finished sixth grade. So that was a fairly normal Midwestern upbringing. We never knew we were poor, but I'd say my dad worked really hard to make sure that we had a great upbringing.
As you look back now, being deeply rooted in ag, as you look back on those summers at your grandfather's farm, how do you view that early time? Is it, I wish I could rewind the clocks and spend more time there, or I'm glad I did it, but it's not something I need to go back and do again?
Yeah, you're right. It's kind of mixed. I mean, I certainly would wish I had more time with my grandfather and my dad on the farm, but they taught me how to work hard. Had the opportunity there. But I think that I took the right path because I'm a tinkerer. I'm a problem solver. I don't think my skills were best fit being on the farm, but I absolutely have this desire to how do we help farming. How do we make it better? How do we make it easier? How do we make it, and knowing it's still going to be really hard work, but I think my path worked out just fine. And I like the blend between understanding just enough about farming mm-hmm. and technology to be standing in the middle, to be, how do we help that the entire industry?
Yeah, I think my kids are middle age, if you will, now 14 down to 8, and we're on a small farm. And I often think back about, or I often wonder when they're my age, if they'll think back on those chores and hot summers and wonder, man, I couldn't get away from that fast enough, or if they'll be at a place where they can still maybe extract some modicum of, that was really terrible at the time, but I can at least understand why. And it maybe made me in some respects into who I am, or at least a little bit better than what I was.
Yeah, my dad, I think, had this philosophy. I don't know if he actually said this, but I always believe like he did say it. My dad's passed, my grandfather's passed, but my dad said, you're going to learn how to work hard. I hope that you learn how to work smart, and then decide what path is right for you, but you'll always know how to work hard.
Yeah, there's no downside to that,
Right.
right?
Yep.
Where did the military, where and when did the military start to come into your sphere of influence or understanding?
Yeah, high school, my dad was drafted. My grandfather actually served at the tail end of World War I. He was the one who was up on the farm, but I had a lot of uncles that were military, mostly Army, some Air Force. So I always had a very positive feeling about military. I knew I wanted to go to college. I knew my dad didn't have the money for that. I had decent grades. I thought I would get, some scholarships, but I actually walked into a, Army recruiting office and they were like, "Tom, we have one space left." And
And you got
interest,
it.
yeah. It interesting enough, it was with the 12th Special Forces Group. And also interesting enough, it was the role that was open was 54, so it was nuclear biological chemical specialist. I loved chemistry. I loved what the recruiter talked about and talked about, hey, getting some help with college, learning a skill, and I felt like, hey, it's a great blend for me. So it was really, I was 17 still at the time. And actually, my parents had to sign my entry documents because I actually signed up a month before my 18th birthday. So,
How did they take that decision?
my dad was fine with it. I think it was my mom was sort of like, "Oh no, you're going away." It was like, but no, I think it's the initial mom reaction. But no, she was actually really supportive and, two of my brothers served also, and so she kind of had to, come to grips with it. But yeah, she was good.
Year was that?
86, so November 86, I actually
86.
signed.
Okay. I won't tell you how old I am or when I was born.
I got some gray hairs, Mike. So
We'll
yes.
leave that one be for a second. So, did you know at the time that, or did you think that this was going to be something temporary and it was a pathway towards a college education? Or how did you approach coming into that?
I thought that, right. I really believed it was just a pathway, assistance to get, through college. But I didn't discount the fact that if I enjoyed it enough, I would have stuck around. So yeah, I was very happy with the decision. Man, I met a lot of great people, did a lot of great training, and was able to go to school. I was on this interesting program because I was in the, I signed up with the 12th group was actually one of the last two reserve special forces units. And so had the opportunity to do this staggered entry. So I left high school, went to basic training, came back for 2 semesters of college, and then I went back for AIT, jump school. So I was gone for almost 9 months after that and came back, finished one more semester of college, went back for more training, and then I, finished my college time up.
I had no idea outside of a scholarship with a university that you could do this sort of back and forth program on the enlisted route.
I was, yeah, I, you know, I was, I'd say I was lucky to be able to, have that opportunity to do that.
So, did you get a commission after you finished college?
No, I actually was enlisted. So
Okay.
I actually, yeah. So I actually stuck with there was actually an officer role also, but I stuck with the enlisted role because I actually liked the job. I mean, once I went in there, it was interesting because my very first, meeting with the 12th group was on a weekend. It was a reserve unit. 86, there was a lot of folks that were still coming back from, had come back from Vietnam. Things were just starting to heat up kind of in the, Middle East. Just some grumblings, but great folks. And I came in civilian gear and was immediately thrown into the supply NBC room and said, "Hey, here's all the materials. You're teaching a class later today." And I'm like, I'm a 17-year-old kid. Like, what are you talking about? So,
Yeah.
Open up manuals and learned a little bit of something about chemical deployment. And by after lunch, I was already teaching a class. So that's what that unit was all about. So it was jump in and take it. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
For those who are not familiar with the nuclear, biological, and chemistry or chemical profession, can you describe that in a little more detail?
Sure. It's really a focus on the ability to detect, identify whether or not you're getting into a nuclear, biological, chemical war, okay? Be able to detect, avoid, and decontaminate, and be able to operate in that environment. So my job was actually to teach my unit if we had a chemical war, if we had a biological war, if we had a nuclear war, like how do you survive and how do you continue to operate as a soldier in those environments. And so I learned about chemical deployments and biological warfare deployment. If a nuke was actually launched, what do you do? How bad could it be? And then everything down to Mike, you should probably remember that, when you hear about, gas, 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 and people, I was the one who was, teaching everybody, okay, what to do? How do you put your mask on? How do you put your mop suit on? How do you put your protective gear on and operate and still be able to do your job, under those conditions?
Yeah, those were some of the more difficult aspects of training that we did at the infantry officer course. It was sort of this whole idea of it was integrated into different training evolutions. And just simple things like reading a map or going to the bathroom, in a full mop suit it's problematic in a lot of ways.
Get a drink of water while you're at it.
Yeah,
Oh.
right. This was in at 86. Did you or were you a part of the initial Gulf War in the early 90s?
I was not deployed, interesting
Okay.
enough. I mean, so I joined 86, went to basic in summer of 87. And then I didn't do AIT till start of summer of 88. So I actually didn't even come out of jump school till end of 88. So it was November of 88. I came out, it was fully trained. So yeah, golf was starting to gear up. We did have some guys, that ended up going, but interesting enough, 12th Group was actually designated a cold weather unit because it came out of, the Russians and all the Cold War and in Cold War two ways, I say because we were a cold, weather unit designation. And so we did a lot of training up in Wisconsin under those conditions. And so when things broke out in the Middle East, in 89 or early 89, we were kind of the last on the list, to go. If things got really bad, they, would have called some folks up, but they mostly wanted to keep the unit intact.
Okay. Is there an event or a story or an experience that occurred during any of that military service that you reach back to today, good, bad, ugly, that has stuck with you or shaped the way you think about something?
Oh, m many of them. Probably number one is, I come out of high school with a little bit of an ego. I mean, I was a skinny little, I say nerd. I was a nerd, Mike, back in school. A little bit of a chip on my soul, shoulder, only because I didn't have all the athletic skills all the other, kids did. I didn't work out, and stuff like that. So, initially I got a lot of flack, like, you joined what? Special forces? No way, you're never gonna make it, and such. But I probably the biggest thing was just when I had really an amazing two amazing drill sergeants, one in basic, one in AIT, and they kind of took me aside and was sort of like, hey, get rid of the attitude or the ego, check the ego, just do your job, head down, get your stuff done. And I ended up, coming out of both, basic and AIT, top of class, and because of them. And I think that was the biggest thing was just, just go to work and be silent and people will see what you're up to. And so, but I absolutely loved it. Loved the training. Knew I had to focus because the physical side for me was the hardest. It wasn't the mental side of it. That I kind of enjoyed actually. I mean, some of the mind games and the work that needed to be done. But chem school was really, fun for me because I had a lot of chemistry. I had already, by the time I went to chem school, I had a year of college under me. I was in honors classes in college, and so I really enjoyed how I could learn that stuff. And interesting enough, Mike, not to speed ahead, but it's actually applied to what I'm working on now. So
I was going to ask if there was a connection there, and let's not lose that thought. I want to connect a few dots in terms of the transition process out. When did you know that it was time to move on from the army?
yeah, so I re-upped in let's see, I re-upped in 93. So I got out, I exited in November 95. At that point, I had already started a full-time job. I'd finished college, was working in Cincinnati, Ohio. And actually, interesting enough, I transferred units from the 12th group to the 11th group, which was the only other reserve SF unit out of Columbus, Ohio. So whole group, new group of guys that I was working with. I mean, amazing, amazing people that I got a chance to work with up there. Did some, fun stuff. But at that point, I knew that the both of those units were being disbanded. I didn't see any other NBC job that was around, and so therefore I was like, okay, I did enough. I served my, total of 9 years. I think it was total, in that. And decided to focus on, at that point I already had a couple of I had one son. I knew I was gonna, have a family, and I had a decent career. And so I said, okay, I did my part. If they ever called back, I would have jumped right back in an instant. But it was enough, and focused on my, family and career at that point.
What type of early work did you do as you transitioned out, and how did you decide that that's where you wanted to start?
Yeah, so I finished my degree in chemical engineering at the University of Illinois. I had a couple different job offers. The one that was most appealing to me was working at Procter and Gamble and doing research and development. And I had the opportunity to go to Green Bay, super cold, or go to Cincinnati, not so super cold. So I chose Cincinnati. Plus, I liked the work that was going on. I had an opportunity to do research, and on new products. And so I thought that was a little bit more exciting than working at a chemical plant in some of the other opportunities that were out there.
What type of chemical engineering work in an R&D capacity is Procter and Gamble doing, or was Procter and Gamble doing?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to start with Head and Shoulders, so a global brand product, and my very first job out of the gate was really twofold: was make it better, make it less expensive. And so, as a chemical engineer, we were working with new materials. When you see on the side of a bottle of shampoo, new and improved, well, there's chemists, chemical engineers, analysts, lab assistants, a whole lot of people behind that. And so, I was one piece of the puzzle. And had an opportunity to develop some new products, materials that were in there. Got a couple of patents as part of that, and so worked at developing new formulations. And so when you're dealing with fluids, in shampoos, you have to make sure that it's the right viscosity, that it's the right formulation that's actually effective, that it's treating dandruff. And so I worked on Head and Shoulders for several years, then got a chance to work with Pantene Pro-V, Vidal Sassoon. I worked with some pumps and pump technology. So that's what we did, and it was great. And as part of that, because I was kind of a nerd on the side, Mike, I got the opportunity to work with some computer systems, everything from some custom systems that we created to large scale ERP, and got introduced to a product called SAP, which is one of the largest, computer systems on the planet that helps large enterprise customers.
Interesting. I never would have thought that there would have been a heavy software computer element in a consumer product like this.
Huge. As a matter of fact, we used it from everything from lab testing. I mean, so we had to, get testing results to formulations to procurement, to supply chain. I mean, so Procter and Gamble was introducing these large scale systems. We were starting to introduce them in R&D. And because I was kind of a nerd on the side, I had done some programming in high school and certainly through college. And a lot of it was, being able to program in the chemical engineering sense. I mean, when you're running pumps and tanks and systems, there's a lot of software involved and controllers involved in all those systems to manage temperature and flow and such. And so, I spanned a little bit of both. I understood enough about the programming, but I got involved in actually creating some custom programs and actually won a couple awards at Procter and Gamble for creating some custom software for the entire R&D division to use to do things.
This seems like a really rewarding place to be, Tom. Why the decision to move on?
I think it was I enjoyed being in between. So when I started at Procter and Gamble, I had a lab and I was, working in, being a chemical engineer. When I started doing software, I'm like, boy, I like this. But I really realized I enjoyed being in between, which was knowing enough about the software, knowing enough about the engineering to solve the problem in between. And I saw there weren't as many people out there doing that. There were software programmers that could program really good, and there were engineers doing engineering work. I mean, people out there creating materials and, everything from electrical engineers, software, I mean, chemical, electrical, nuclear, whatever, doing their work because they loved being engineers. I really enjoyed being in between, knowing enough, just enough about both. Now, how do you solve the problem? How do you get the two together to talk? And I could talk to both of them. I could talk to an engineer, but I could also talk to a programmer and say, hey, I need your programmer to do this and display it like this because that's how the engineer thinks. And so that's why I actually left industry and moved into consulting and spent, 23, 24 years really in the consulting world, helping to deploy, technology for businesses.
Got it. Okay. Where does agriculture come into the mix here?
The nice thing was is that I had some bits and pieces of it over those 22 years. So as part of working for some smaller and even some larger consulting firms like Deloitte, I had the opportunity to work for companies like Archer Daniels Midland,
Okay.
CGB, CHS, a little project for Cargill. So I ended up Ardent Mills. So I mean, some really big, and I had the opportunity to talk with some of those, folks in the C-suite because I was bringing in large-scale technologies to help them, transform and, their companies. And so I was the one who had to come in and say, hey, here's why you need this piece of software, and oh, let's go put it in place. Here's the business case behind why you're going to use this piece of software, and oh, by the way, you're going to spend $100 million to buy it. But it's going to save you $1 billion. So those were the types of business cases I had the chance to come in and share. And as part of that, I really learned a lot more about the inner workings of what were the big ag companies doing, how they were getting their supplies, what data and information they were getting. And all that came up to kind of the revelation about 5 years ago, Mike. I think it was about that I was like, holy cow, there's this big gap. There's this big gap of not having that data at the ground level of farms. Like the big ag companies only can get so far. They don't know exactly what's happening on the ground with soil and crops and pests and disease and so forth. And so that was really the birth of my idea of ag tech logic. And it started down an interesting path, but it was those 22 years of having the opportunity to work in there. And, as part of that, I actually, interesting enough, I took a commodities course. For all those who grew up in the Midwest, my mom always had the radio on. And so I listened to Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong ever since I was a kid. Now, I didn't know who they were, Mike, when I was a kid, when they were talking about, pork bellies are selling at $16 and blah, 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 and corn selling this and wheat's doing that. I was like, what is this, Mom? And my mom didn't know much either, but but I eventually took a commodities course and I'm like, oh, I get it. I understand the, end-to-end supply chain, and that's what culminated into this idea.
There are quite a few gaps among large corporates when it comes to farm-based data or ground truth-based data, soil health, loss at combines during harvest, yield for cotton harvesters. How did you settle on the one that built? The one that was the foundation that would become AgTech Logic.
Yeah, it was a combination. I was talking to a friend of mine. It was actually one of our very last Boy Scout meetings I was leading. And I remember this because the meeting got over, and I'm talking to a friend of mine, Alberto, who's an agronomist. And he was talking about, I was asking about his job, and he had been an agronomist for some 15, 18 years at that point. And he was talking about the problems we had with weeds and water and labor. And I said, well, tell me more. What's the problem with weeds? And at that point, Mike, I had moved to Arizona, and I was sort of surprised, because I'm like, you're dealing with weeds in Arizona. He's like, oh yeah, Tom, you have no idea. And I'm like, well, I knew weeds are a problem. I mean, growing up, I mean, seeing them as a kid in the yard, or going up to the farm and seeing them out there. But I dove deeper into it, and I found out, weeds are a huge problem. And and I understood that how people were spraying for weeds, in a broadcast mode. And I was actually really shocked, Mike, that people weren't using more precision spray applications. I was blown away. Why is that? Why isn't this technology out there? And it was really two reasons. Number one, growers didn't believe the numbers. They didn't really have the facts and the data to prove out that precision spraying was really hitting their bottom line and they could prove it out. And number two, the technology, although it'd been around for a while, wasn't maturing fast enough to do what needed to get done. And that is precisely spray where you need to spray, when you need to spray, and still, be easy to operate. It's still got to be easy. It can't be arduous for the grower, to have to deal with some fancy technology, and they're not going to go boot up a computer and hit a couple of buttons before they get going. They just want it to work. So those are the two things that I saw were challenges. And Mike, I seriously like threw my hands up. I'm like, we could solve this. I know we could solve this, and so at that point I decided that's it. I was kind of done working for anybody else. I was going to dive everything I had into, into solving this problem.
5 years ago, COVID time. Is that about when this started to take
Right before,
seat?
yeah, right before COVID, correct.
Okay. How did that unfold or affect initial kind of development for you guys?
Well, it started with research. So I was researching the different technologies that were out there, and it came across one of the technologies, and I'll share because I think it's relevant to a technology called Weedit, that was using a certain type of chlorophyll fluorescence sensor. And I'm like, wow, this is brilliant. And I was blown away, like, why isn't everybody using this? And I think part of it, again, was back to my two points, was you needed the data, you needed to prove it out, the financials needed to work out also. And so I first jumped in as a dealer in there while I was working on the concept around what I was doing. So I was still doing some consulting work at the time when I originally started formulating what I was doing. I had a previous name of a company that was really awful. And then, we came up with a better name by September of 21. But in the early stages, it was a lot of research. I actually created a custom three-row sprayer to work within, rows to spray with that technology. And it proved out. I'm like, wow, this is really great technology. It's accurate. It's affordable. I know the numbers are there. So now it was a matter of, okay, I got to prove it out. I got to get some sales, got to, generate some income, while I'm working on my bigger play, which was the data play. How do we use data imaging and so forth to wrap around there to prove out the business case, which ultimately, Mike, gets the data back to the big corporate. Right. How do you get that last bit of data that isn't being captured today? And so that's where I started. So I started with precision spraying, and then I started developing my technology around that.
Describe this integration between Weedit and AgTech Logic. How do those two things work in collaboration?
Yeah, so it's, I again love the technology, and we started to deploy that. We started to demo it, and actually we got a couple of we got some traction with a couple of growers, and they were like, okay, this looks great. One was a large vineyard out in California. They're like, hey, we believe the numbers. It was actually a financial conversation, not a technology conversation with them initially. And so they bought based on the finances. They're like, Tom, we see your background. We understand that you bring technology in. If the numbers work out, we're going to continue to deploy something like this. So we started to get some traction there. But ultimately, I knew that I had to be able to prove out the numbers. And so I originally created the entire hardware software design around a product that was going to retrofit onto any type of sprayer that could capture all the data, meaning everything from where are you spraying, when are you spraying, how are you spraying, and then show that in any device. And the numbers had to be accurate. I had to be able to prove out, flow, GPS location, had to get it in fairly real time, had to show that versus broadcast. And if you could prove out the numbers and put that into somebody's P&L, then they could be like, great, I can justify the purchase of this type of technology. And so that's been my goal from the beginning is, which that's what I did for 20 some years, was I had to go convince people, hey, you need this technology because the numbers make sense. It's a financial decision, not a technology decision. Obviously, the technology's got to work, got to be easy. It's got to integrate to others. And so we created AgTelio, our product, to wrap around Weedit, but also it could add on to any sprayer, whether you had a precision sprayer or not. And then we realized that the data was so important that we're getting and getting a lot of inquiries now about just using it as a scouting tool. So we started with precision spray. We've now evolved to the point that it's the data that really is the gold. And that data can prove out many different, business cases. So precision spray is our number one focus, but beyond that, it's, early identification of disease. We can find puddling now or standing water. We were just asked, we just started to deploy at another large grower in California. We were just asked, can you find and identify things on the ground like groundhog holes, ground squirrels, the holes, and map those out for us? And we're like, we sure can. And we are. So
Describe how the AgTelio product works in union with the Weedit system.
yeah, so we created an independent product. So we actually developed the hardware, which is a box, and inside there is compute capability, and it's a plug and play. So we've got ability to add different types of connections to that. So right now, what it does is Weedit feeds it data, in addition to the fact that we're capturing separately flow rate, GPS, and then we have communication connected to that. So we can then broadcast that information onto our into the cloud, into your hands, any device, into our app. And so we can actually work completely independent of Weedit. So we're not doing anything Frankenstein with it. So it simply just plugs into and around the Weedit system. But again, it could plug into any type of sprayer. So if you have a conventional sprayer, I could throw it on there and it could start to gather data for you and even understand, weed density, without any precision technology with it.
So if it's used in combination with the Weedit system, then the chlorophyll fluorescent sensor on that is what is triggering the spot spraying mechanism to occur.
That's correct. And then
Okay.
we can capture the image of what that weed looks like. We could tell you exactly where it's sprayed, how often it's sprayed. And the biggest thing is the savings. So now that you can actually see that if you broadcasted all those nozzles at your application rate, you would have used in that case, maybe you would have used 1,000 gallons. We now know that, hey, if you only ended up using 300 gallons, we know that very accurately now. We know where and how you sprayed that. And so now we can show you, hey, the savings you believed you had because you were looking at a bubble on a tank. And you know, before it was like, yes, I know I'm saving using the product, but I don't know how much. And I don't know where I'm spraying, how I'm spraying. And so now we map all of that for you.
Are those numbers really, those numbers you just gave around 1,000 versus 300, are those really where those sort of pan out?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing up to 90% savings, you know, in certain use cases with that combination.
With as similar of an efficacy as possible, or as
yes. Yes.
Similar
Yeah.
efficacy?
Yeah. And again, different use cases, you know, Mike, and different weed, you know, densities, depending on the time of the year. You know, our vineyard grower starts out, you know, a lot of weeds, you know, and eventually seeing much better control. As a matter of fact, using the combination and seeing it prove out. I mean, one of our growers is planning on using that combination of Agtelio and Weed It more often because they are getting such great savings that they're getting better weed management. So, and therefore they're getting better weed management. They're seeing less opportunity to have to deal with those weeds. And therefore, you know, if you don't let them seed, you just get better control.
Can the Agtelio system work in the absence of the Weed It system?
Yes. So
How?
It's working as a scout capability also. So we're
okay.
actually now applying it to just a, if you have a side-by-side UTV, we've actually started to work with a larger OEM, and using that technology, you can apply it to a side-by-side and, you know, have the ability to go scout your farm. You know, that if you just, you know, so it's very, very affordable to throw that on there and then be able to start to gather data. And that's really where we see that product going, is that a farmer could put it on, start getting data, and decide, do I need to go to precision spray? We can actually also integrate other data that they may be getting from drone, other equipment, you know, into a single panel, into a single UI, that they can then look at the data and determine other factors that they may want to look at.
Can that Agtelio system by itself still control nozzle function on the sprayer boom?
It can.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
We have the ability to do that.
This is often something that comes up a lot in companies as they have proven early traction, but as they start to sort of figure out which opportunities to go after. You mentioned that this system could potentially be used in scouting. We can detect puddling. We can do standing water. This grower or producer says, man, wouldn't it be cool if it could do that? These guys over here are saying, man, I wish that it would do this. How do you manage all of this opportunity input and determine how to prioritize and which way to go based off that?
Yeah, well, certainly as an entrepreneur, you have to focus. I have to say that we had a bit of a shotgun approach in 23, maybe early 24, but now we're heavily focused now in specialty crops. So vineyards, citrus, nuts is really our focus in the Central Valley. You know, we've got some really good customers we're working with right now. So that's our focus, but the nice thing is that the capability can absolutely be used in a lot of different crops and combinations. We've been invited into a couple of other big growers' centers to go prove out the technology, but we're being very cautious about making sure that, you know, it's the right fit before we walk in there. So yeah, we're staying laser focused in specialty crops, in the combinations we think that we can do really well with, continue to get better traction. Make sure we get, you know, profitable. We'll see profitability this year, which is nice. And then we can work on other combinations. But some of the things, Mike, I mean, we were at World Ag Expo, and there was a group that came to us, and they're in South America, and they have three shifts of people that are spraying for weeds, and so they've got a night shift, and they honestly came to us and said, hey, if we just put this on our sprayers, can we track and see, you know, to make sure that the guys are actually spraying where they're supposed to be spraying? And the answer was absolutely. Our product can absolutely do that for you. And it'll do it in near real time. So you can absolutely see, like, You know, if a tractor's sitting out there idle for too long, if it's not driving down the right row, and we're like, yep, absolutely, you could do that. And they're like, oh, okay. And they were kind of scratching there, like, hey, why, what's up? And they're like, we're not sure if our third string crew, the night shift is actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, yeah, that's certainly part of it. And I think that's part of why, you think in transportation over the last decade, right? I mean, the telemetry that, that big growers need to know that the materials are being used, effectively, by label. And so I do believe that Actelio could absolutely be, be a product that could help in track and trace and report on, are you deploying chemicals the right way and, the way that you expect them to. So.
And this is primarily enabled through the GPS system that resides in the Actelio product.
Correct, to be able to track that. Yes.
Yeah.
We've got different GPSs that we have for different use cases, and we're working with actually one of our partners, one of the dealers up in Central Valley. I mean, been a great partner with us to work on even new GPS combinations. We're working with a partner out of Pittsburgh, working on different technology to prove out GPSs. Because again, when you're working under canopy, you need different capabilities. And we're actually finding really good success. So we've got some very good and early success with some of these different combinations. And again, the data's got to prove out financially. So.
It's interesting. So combinations of different GPSs in a single system in an effort to give you higher resolution position data.
That's correct.
Interesting.
Yep. And again, plug and play, that again,
Right.
if you need to change one out, okay, great. I'm going to go from GPS version A to version B. Okay, great. I can just pop that out and just keep going. I mean, that's our intent of the Actelio system. It's going to be that simple. You don't need to call us out for a service call. I mean, if you accidentally, snag something and drag a camera off, look, just pop it out, plug a new one in, and keep going. So.
I would presume then, because it can still do nozzle operation in the absence of a chlorophyll sensor and that it's using cameras, that there's a strong artificial intelligence component to being able to detect the difference between weeds and plants. Is that correct?
There is, correct.
Okay.
We're primarily using our AI right now for weed identification and, foreign object detection, like standing water and
Okay.
groundhog holes and such. But yes, that's continued to evolve as we're moving forward about what's the different use cases needed, for that. But for detection of weeds, especially in a green on brown situation, honestly, we believe there is no better combination than weeded and Actelio.
Right. And in green on brown, meaning
Green on brown,
weeds in a
correct.
row, weeds in the space between the rows where you shouldn't see any green.
Correct. But we're also testing out, we're finding that there's a lot of green on green use cases that
Yes.
we can do.
Yes.
And so I'm not going to get into all the secret sauce, Mike, because we've done some
Understood.
stuff that I'll just give the smirk that the combination of the two provides us the
Yeah.
ability to do a lot more green on green capabilities and differentiate things that can ensure that you're not spraying the things you don't want to.
Right. And this is sort of the big, I think, leap that technology has made. That has allowed it to progress beyond just green on brown situations in exactly the scenario that you just described, where you have green weeds mixed in with green plants. Chlorophyll sensors are they're very difficult to use, if not impossible, in that sort of situation. So you need something that can recognize whatever it is that this is.
Well, yes. I'll just say that there's some good work going on, Mike,
Okay.
that might challenge that just a little bit.
Ah,
Okay.
okay. Interesting.
I'll just say that we're finding
Okay.
interesting ideas because what
Okay.
you don't want to have to do is always affect the plumbing, right? That if you could affect just the nozzles, and where you
Right.
are spraying, because certain growers have a lot of different combinations of where they want to spray. Yes, I want to spray the berm. I don't want to spray the berm. I don't want to spray by a certain location. Hey, I'm going to let that, overgrown grass or cover crop, grow, but I don't want to have to go out and shut these things off or, and we've got growers right now that are having to turn, booms on or off. I mean, manually, with switches and such. And in the future, you won't have to do that. We're already, we have the ability to program through software, what they want. And therefore, then the sprayer is going to identify, know exactly where they're at, what the conditions are, and determine exactly how they want to operate in those conditions. And so one of our growers that we're working with has over, 36 combinations of boom adaptability, and we've already programmed that all into AgTelio. And so if
Interesting.
we could do those, combinations that are very complex, we know that there's a lot out there that's, not as complex, and they're going to be able to, reap the benefits of some of that.
There's more to this than just weed detection in unwanted spots. There is an entire, what I'm hearing you say is there's this entire customization aspect of that sprayer operating in a real world farm environment that would be benefited by custom applications or controls beyond just spray this weed, don't spray that plant.
Yeah, one of the biggest benefits is working with dealers. Many of these dealers, and you know this today, when a dealer sells a sprayer today, they sell it and they say, "See you later, Farmer John," right? Bye, and the dealer doesn't know there's a problem till Farmer John calls up and said, "Hey, this isn't working," right? And they're like, "Oh, what's the problem?" "Well, we don't know. There's nozzles clogged, there's solenoids not working. I don't know. My guy ran it into a pole or whatever." "Okay, great. We'll send somebody out, And so you got to send somebody out and check out what's going on. Well, AgTelio now helps you to understand and avoid some of that stuff. With the cameras and technology we put on it, you can see a lot of early data and information that can be useful for that combination for the farmer to work, the grower to work with the dealer. And so we see a clogged nozzle, we see flow not going. The cameras are, the cameras can be in positions to not just look at weeds, but also look at the spray and the spray pattern. If somebody changed out nozzles, Mike, we could tell, like, "Hey, you changed the nozzles." We could see that. We could see your flow rate changed. I mean, so dealers having that data for the growers that want to work and integrate with their dealers, the dealers are going to be able to operate again with in this world of lack of labor. And if your sprayer goes down, you have a problem, you got to call somebody and get that service done. You now have the ability to service faster, communicate with dealers. Dealers are going to be far more effective. They're going to be more efficient. Growers are going to be happier because that data is going to the right person to drive the right, next step and result and action that has to occur.
For you all as a business, do you think there's an additional revenue stream here that is from the dealers in order to access that use or performance data?
Absolutely. We think the data is going to be relevant to the executive, the C-suite, to the entire supply chain, to the grower, to the dealers. We think ultimately, as the growers, and yet right now, all the data that we capture today is owned between us and the grower. We're not selling data, we're not sharing data. That's our model right now. But what we want to do is work with the growers to say, "Hey, if you allowed, certain suppliers to have this piece of data or that, they could likely be able to get you more effective, more effective process, maybe better pricing, more effective supply chain." I mean, ultimately, we work for the grower. We want the grower to see more profitability in the end. How do we get that? Well, we start with, "Hey, we've got this data, Mr. Grower. How do we help you, leverage this data to make you as successful as possible?" And we think that some of those growers are going to be like, "Yes, I want my dealer to know what's going on because I want them to service before we even know there's a problem." We want, they may want to supply some of that data we're getting with downstream supply chain. We've been told that some of the data that we're collecting, especially on the crops itself, might help in, scouting prior to harvest, scouting prior to, and planning their supply chain as part of harvest, post-harvest activities. And so, again, we think that data is highly valuable. We know it's valuable in other industries. We want to make it, valuable, for the grower first.
The way you're engaging with customers now is a hardware sale package or is it software or subscription?
Yeah, it's hardware software. So, in the case that they may choose to buy the hardware or package the hardware and the software together. And so we've got a monthly subscription that allows you to have unlimited use of the software right now. At some point that might change down the road. But right now we've got a very different model. We're not charging by the acre. So we ultimately believe that once you put Actelio on, the more data you get, the better off you're going to be, and the more valuable, that information is going to be to you. So, so we're, unlimited use once you have it.
Okay. Because of all of the really good points you just described around additional information and insight that can be gathered through trips and passes in the field that are already occurring, you've also talked a lot about this as a retrofit system. Wouldn't a deer or a Kubota or a CNH have interest in having this be an integrated solution to their booms or their sprayers that are sold right out of the factories themselves?
Yeah, we certainly think so. I think that we've had some conversations with some folks. I mean, we ultimately believe that, yeah, retrofit, brand new, we think that it absolutely is going to add value. And so we're continuing to explore those ideas, but we got to continue to prove out what we're doing. So we hope if they come a knock in that we're ready for that.
Well, not to shoot that opportunity in the foot here, but why do you think the See & Spray at John Deere, the original Blue River technology, why is that not more widely adopted? Why isn't it more commercialized? They bought it in 2017. It's 2025. What's going on?
Yeah, my understanding, Mike, again, I mean, yeah, John Deere, they spent a lot of money in that. I know that they've invested a fair amount of dollars into that too. I started doing research actually even years before, when I started the company. I spent a lot of time doing a lot of research. And again, as a chemical engineer, I mean, I actually reopened a lot of the books, and I'm like, wow, that's why I got this degree. But I spent a lot of time, and I was lucky enough too. My dad was an electrician. I did a lot of electronic work when I was a kid. So my dad taught me electrical, plumbing, carpentry. And so it really all culminated into this, which was, as I started looking at the research, I believed that image alone wasn't going to do it. So to be honest, I mean, I know that Deere's using image, I believe that they're using image only. Now they may be using other sensors and combinations now, in their technology too. But I had a belief that it's going to be a combination of sensors that is needed in order to do what you needed to do. And we did happen to be really, I mean, again, I believe the most accurate and affordable green on brown technology and its specialty crops and what we're doing has been the best partner for us. And so, wrapping the cameras around that system just made sense. And I'm like, boy, the two together is going to be powerful. And it is. And we're finding ways to make Actelio less expensive, easier to deploy. We now have a partner out of Tucson, Arizona, the Beacon Group, that is working with us, along with a couple of other partners, developing and looking at how do we, continue to develop the technology, along with, working with you guys too, Mike. But I think, and we've already got some plans. We've got three patents pending. We've got four more drafted. I believe it's a combination of sensors that will ultimately win in the marketplace. But I think the other thing, and we're working with, some partners on this, which is bringing all of that to the edge. And, edge technology is getting faster, less expensive. And once we're able to do that, I think we're going to be able to have systems that are very easy to deploy, less expensive. And I think that's one thing that just separates us from John Deere.
I
So.
would, as a sensor development group in agriculture, I would fully agree with the perspective that it is a multifaceted, multi-capability suite that is most likely to succeed here. But based on that research and in your opinion, I mean, why do you think image recognition or images through cameras alone isn't going to cut it long term?
Well, I think there's so much more information out there. For example, understanding chlorophyll levels, and I think that's the neat thing, about weeded is you can differentiate different chlorophyll levels of different species. And so there's a lot of research going on out there of how that helps, understanding moisture, temperature, microclimates. I think all of that, in combination is going to help us to understand what you're looking to do. So I'm just saying is that images are definitely going to be part of it, but it's
Yes.
not the only slice. I mean, in order to help a farmer, I mean, my ultimate goal, and by the way, I certainly wish John Deere all the best because as an industry, we want that, right? We want, the capability to reduce pesticide use. It's coming. We know that it's coming with the administration. It's coming because consumers want it. It's coming because farmers can't continue to afford, the input costs. So we know there's got to be more of this, push. But images is just a slice of what we need in order to help a farmer to become a really good farmer. So we believe that Agtelio is a piece of the puzzle to help. If you're a good farmer, you can become a great farmer. If
Yeah.
you're a mediocre farmer, you could become a good farmer because of Agtelio, because we could start to help and diagnose things that you can't do on your own. Now that you've got this data, of your farm, you can ingest data from external sources and combine it. So one of the things we're already starting to do is you identify a weed and maybe you see that that weed's persistent, so it's got weed resistant to your formulation. How about the ability that a farmer, instead of going, home at night and having to look up all the research studies or call an agronomist or call a local dealer and say, look, this weed, which I now know what it is, it's just not dying and it's really giving me trouble. I mean, we believe that Actelio will be able to, and we're starting this, be able to ingest that external data. And let's say this scenario, Mike, where it pulls in data from UC Davis that did a recent study on that weed, and it tells that farmer right there, look, recent study by UC Davis tells you that this formula with this, application amount kills that weed. That farmer becomes instantly smart.
Like a Google Scholar
Awesome.
application in a real-time fashion, but for weeds and plants and agriculture.
Right. But, detection of disease, pest,
Yeah.
ground rodent issues, weather and climate issues, all of that combined to help you decide, like, why do I have this weed? Why is my crop growing like this? Why do I have this issue? Ultimately, we believe it's data and it's going to require a multifaceted, ability. So that's why, working with you guys and some others, I mean, we want that easy plug and play capability. And each situation is going to be a little bit different. I mean, we were asked by a grower, recently, like, hey, Tom, can you throw an anemometer, a wind speed meter on there? And we're like, we sure can. Because they're like, we want to know wind speed under canopy. We're like, yeah, that makes sense. Because if I know the wind speed under canopy, I can decide whether or not I should or shouldn't spray.
Because
And
of drift.
yep, because of drift, right? And so ultimately, if you've got that capability, you can shut off nozzles or turn off the system or alert the grower or alert the manager, the operations manager, like, hey, the winds have just picked up, like, don't spray. You don't want to be liable for drift. And
That's
so,
good.
there's, I don't know, I think I read the stat in California alone, it was something like $127 million worth of lawsuits, in 2022, because of chemical drift. And so ultimately, if you're a grower and you can prove out, like, I didn't spray because, my system, Agtelio, was what monitoring wind speed, application rate, my nozzles, all of that. Like, look, I have the proof. It wasn't me.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be part of the equation.
You're right. There's an entire industry around drift control with adjuvants and additives into these chemicals themselves so that they become heavier and don't move as much in these wind conditions because of the problem that you just described and how significant it is. And
Yep. And
if,
it's not going to be just weeds, right? I think it's going to be,
correct.
right,
No, correct.
adjuvants, fertilizers, I mean,
Right.
biostimulants, you name it, right? You want to be able to deploy. I mean, we talk about the 4 R's, and the 4 R's are on a piece of paper, right? And then you go out and you make sure you're like, yep, I'm doing the 4 R's. But there's nothing out there that proves that you're doing the 4 R's,
Right,
right?
right, right.
We now have a system that actually monitors, you're doing the 4 hours. You're actually tracking everything.
And that information potentially becomes valuable to crop insurance providers as they potentially make a claim, or to your point about a lawsuit about a drift case, if that information underpins a scientifically underpins a decision, or it can be valuable in those kinds of applications as well.
Yes, correct.
This is kind of a wild thing you guys are doing, but the SpaceX mission 32 to Mars. I mean, what if I've got any of that wrong, correct me, but describe that in more detail if you can.
Sure. We were part of the AgTech Accelerator down with Generator in Huntsville, Alabama, home of the space program and a lot of engineers. And the program director down there, Chris Udall, has been working with NASA, SpaceX, and in several different contexts. And Rhodium Scientific has been part of this also. And what they were able to do is put together a program to find some veteran-owned businesses, ag tech businesses. And so there are four businesses that were a part of this, me and three other veterans that own an ag tech business. And they basically came up with the concept of what if we did some ag tech work in space? And so they've started this program. It's still early on, but we've got the opportunity to work with those groups to bring technology into space and see how we can help hopefully ultimately help with the missions to Mars, right? And ultimately it's doing the research and work that could actually change what we're doing here on the ground too. So
Have they given you any indication, or have you proposed any specific experiments that you want to try to perform or accomplish?
yes. So the first set of experiments are going to be sending some seeds into space. So they may be, for crops or for weeds. And so we're actually in combination working with Texas A&M. They purchased our technology, and now we're working and doing some R&D with Texas A&M. Great folks out there at Texas A&M AgriLife. And so the intent is to fly some seeds to space, bring them back down, and then see based on their conditions in space how they change here. So whether it be weeds or crops, do they grow differently? Is the biology different? Do they do different formulations of herbicides affect those weed seeds and so forth? And so we have set out some experiments that we're looking to do. And ultimately what we want is AgTelio to be able to capture all of that data, whether they're in space or whether it's here on the ground. AgTelio's capturing the growth, data is along with the growth of those weed seeds or the crop seeds or the combination of that.
Interesting. Well, to the extent that that will be something that can be followed publicly, I'd love to keep apprised as that takes shape. To come sort of full circle here, since we're now talking about veteran companies, ag tech companies owned by veterans, you have at least one other veteran that works with AgTech Logic. Why and how do you think that the veteran community is a good fit in the ag tech space?
I really appreciate that conversation. Again, I am a little partial. I worked with a lot of folks in the military. The nice thing that I really like is the fact that they always seem to show up on time. They show up on time, they work hard, they're dedicated to a mission, right? So if you throw out there is a mission, as a matter of fact, I was just chatting with somebody who's working with a couple of veteran programs about folks that are, coming out of the military, transitioning into, the real world. And he's not military. And I said, one of the things you can do is if you drive home the mission and then just clearly give the mission and the date, like they're going to go after it, right? I mean, that's the way we were programmed in the military, right? We got to go attack that hill by that time. And great. I don't need all the details. I'm going to figure it out. I've got my skills. I'm going to go do it. And so, so yes, Justin Hoffman, is our CTO, great guy, and it was in active duty for, an officer, and You know, it was great. You know, he enjoyed his time. And, you know, I just like the fact that I could throw, hey, here's what we want to do by this date. He's like, Tom, I'm on it. I'm going after it. So.
And it's that sort of ability to operate with a mission and a limited intent that I think is imbued in a lot of, if not all, of military veterans as they transition out, that become this intangible skill that they have the capacity to bring to the entrepreneur space, the agribusiness space, the farming space, the animal tech space. And my hope is that through conversations like this, that veterans begin to recognize that they have that soft skill, if you will, and as they start to think about that as a differentiator when they go into the professional world, that becomes something they can really lean on. It becomes a valuable thing that can be communicated.
I think the other thing, Mike, as we know, especially depending on your role in the military, right? But you know, again, you know this, especially in the Army, everybody's infantry. You know, I know. You know, I mean, everybody's got a role, but you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, everybody's a foot soldier. And so, you know, the ability to, I think there's something about the ability to throw your boots on and get out in the farm. It's just something that you love. I mean, there's just something about putting your boots on, getting out there, and you know, have to, you know, it doesn't matter what the temperature is. You're like, heck, I had worse conditions, you know, in the Army. You know, so you're like, this, nothing. 110 degrees, you know, Central California, 120 degrees. Okay, you know, it's hot or it's humid. You know, it could be Texas, you know, the Texas humidity. And they're like, yep, been there, done that, you know, and they just keep driving forward and, you know, they got a water bottle in hand and just keep working.
That wraps up another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast. A big thank you to Tom Gauthier for joining us and sharing his time and insights. This isn't just another story about AI in ag. Tom's team isn't betting on one singular tool. They recognize that the long-term road to developing a successful solution in ag tech will be multifaceted, which means it may require different types of sensors. In AgTechLogic's case, those sensors include chlorophyll fluorescence, flow rate, GPS, and camera imaging. They're stitching together a system that actually thinks in field, in near real time, and even in under canopy situations. Actelio isn't just spotting weeds, it's detecting things like standing water and ground squirrel holes. Tom even hints at future capabilities which will perform even better in green on green situations. Tom and his team have chosen to focus on communicating to specialty crop producers, agronomists, and OEMs that there is a financial incentive to adopting this type of technology, not just an agronomic one. They're showing growers exactly how much they're saving, where that spray went, and why it worked. In Tom's opinion, this is what earns trust: cold, hard data, grounded in operations. If you want to learn more about what Tom and his team at AgTechLogic are building, head over to agtechlogic, all one word, .com, or find them across social media platforms like X, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can also connect with Tom directly on LinkedIn.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and until next time, stay frosty.